Hi, this is Ron Hogan, and you're listening to Life Stories, the Beatrice.com podcast where I talk to memoir writers about their lives and the art of turning that life into memoir. It's our second episode, and our guest is Storm Large, the author of Crazy Enough. And as an added bonus, we have some songs that Storm sang when she appeared to promote the book at Brooklyn's Powerhouse Arena recently. So here, without any further ado, is Storm Large.
Call me crazy, 'cause I am, and alive, I'm alive. That's the way I turn a nosedive into flight. Call me psycho, 'cause I am, oh, and I am alive. Thank God I am alive. I make music out of the voices in my mind, and this crazy helps me to see.
Crazy Enough for Life Stories. And I guess my first question to you is, so tell me about your mother.
We are on a couch. Oh my goodness. My mom was very sweet, tiny little woman who was just broken straight out of the box and never really got a chance to find her own voice, and that was, I believe, the crazy that she suffered from, other than all of the different diagnoses that she was later handed by the so-called experts in the medical field. But she was given kind of a raw deal, and then was given, you know, then she had me, she had three children, and me being the last and the only girl, I kind of put her through hell myself in trying to get away from her. So, so my mom was lovely, and God bless her. I hope this is a decent homage.
Yeah, I mean, you talk of in experiencing, you know, your childhood years and your adolescent years. That experience of dealing with your mother's, you know, constant cycle of breakdowns and slight recoveries, but, you know, even the slightest recovery is quickly counterbalanced by another swing back.
Yeah.
But of course, I mean, your experience of this as a child is completely different from the way you understand it now.
Oh, yeah. That was kind of the interesting trick of writing the book, was going back to being that kid and understanding and remembering my feelings around her being gone all the time. So when I was little, I believed that I was making her sick. She had a hysterectomy, total hysterectomy, when I was 6 months old. She had really bad endometriosis, among all of her other health issues. But she begged the doctors to let her keep all of her parts until she had a girl. And so she had a terrible miscarriage. And then she finally had me. And then when I was 6 months old, she had her total hysterectomy, is when she really started ramping up trying to kill herself. And that's when my father told me that things, she had always been a little off, but that was, the hysterectomy was really what kicked it into high gear. So being a baby and being a child and loving my mother more than anything on the planet, and having her constantly being taken away from me, and when you're young, you're the center of the universe and everything begins and ends with you, it was my fault. It was because I didn't love her enough. It was because I wasn't good enough. It was because I was bad. I was loud. I was too much to handle. I was tiring, you know.
But eventually there comes a point as you get older where you kind of transition from this is all my fault to, you know, Christ enough already.
Yeah, yeah. That came right around 9, 10, 11, the awakening of... When you're that age, you kind of know, like, there are those kids that hurt themselves on purpose so they can get attention. Mm-hmm. And, like, running a race, little kids running in a race at school or at recess or playing a game, they're not going to win. So they fall down on purpose and hurt themselves so everyone has to stop playing. You recognize that as a child. You're like, you just want attention. And I started to see that, see my mother through that lens. Going, you aren't really sick. You're fine. You just want attention. You're not getting enough attention. Because a lot of her breakdowns and a lot of her suicide attempts happened around birthdays, graduations, weddings, like wonderful, exciting things that were happening. My mother would fall apart, try to kill herself, drive into a tree, you know, jump out of a moving car. And so it started to look like more calculated than crazy.
And... at a certain point, like around this time, when you're getting fed up with it, and she's still going in periodically for committals, there comes this point where you're talking to a doctor, and you say to him, it's like, well, geez, at least I'm not going to be like this when I grow up.
And he says, well, it's hereditary. You absolutely will end up like your mother. But then, you know, but not until your 20s or whenever you have children. Now, so many people react to that part of the story as, what a monster, what a terrible, terrible, irresponsible doctor. Whereas it was bad for me because it was a grown-up speaking out loud the thing I feared the most, the thing I already suspected. And it was just kind of confirmation of what I already believed. Now, in reality, it is hereditary. If my mother did have schizophrenia, if my mother did have manic depression, which is now bipolar disorder, if she did have these actual diseases, they do run in bloodlines. Sometimes they skip generations, but they are generally hereditary, as well as, alcoholism and drug addiction. So he wasn't saying something monstrous. It was irresponsible. But I don't want people to think that the book is a condemnation of the psychiatric industry. Mm-hmm. I have my own issues with pharmaceutical companies and their commercialism. But my problem was with the doctor's cavalier attitude of, I know exactly what's wrong with your mother. She needs this, 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 and she needs to be in this hospital, have this kind of treatment. And it changed with every doctor. And we did everything the doctor said, and they were never right.
And he probably thinks he's being helpful, going, oh, yeah, and brace yourself, because 10, 15 years down the line.
And, yeah, well, he didn't say brace yourself. He said, by the time it happens to you, mm-hmm. we know so much about your mother's illness now that you're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't say that. I'm paraphrasing. But it was really, that was the color of the statement. He's like, you know, you have nothing to worry about. You know, we know so much about your mother. But I'm like, you know nothing about my mother. My mom wants to die. You know, if I'm going to end up like my mom, what that means to me is I'm going to die alone in a hospital with nobody loving me.
and you talk about how, like, you're hearing this at this moment where, like you say, it's your worst fear. And they're talking about how it's like you're at a point where they're looking at you and saying, you know, we ought to start looking at you in this lens. And you talk about how your father was like, okay, you know, there is no way the kids are ever going under this kind of treatment because you've already ruined one family.
Well, my brother Henry did go to see one of my mom's doctors. I don't think it was the doctor that said that to me, but I don't know if I was even, I might have been a baby, but my dad went with my mom because my brother Henry was hyperactive. And something just whatever, typical child thing. And then things started accelerating with my mother, and my dad saw what was happening to my mother, so he absolutely refused anyone to see my brother. And my mom said, she suggested to my dad, well, we really need to have the children looked at. And he said, absolutely not. No way. And so he never did. He wouldn't allow it. He wouldn't allow it.
But part of what happens in the rest of the memoir after that point is, I mean, it's obviously not a totally self-fulfilling prophecy.
No.
But you do, I mean, I get the sense that it's like that off-the-cuff statement in your adolescence certainly gave you, at the very least, a sort of like subconscious leeway.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I you know, I still don't feel like I'm out of the woods. You know, you hear stories of women in their 30s and 40s, they have a baby and they have a psychotic break because of the hormone dump. Or they go through menopause and they start to hear voices. And you hear these stories and some people are like, oh, that's so terrible that happened to that person. And when I hear stories like that, I'm like, fuck, I'm not out of the woods yet. But I did everything in my power to be opposite my mom and ran away from everything I saw her to be, which was weak, a little girl, female. You know, I saw those things as weakness. And so I ran away from all of that to try and run away from the crazy and ran into a bunch of different kind of self-made crazy and stupid, self-destructive, hateful, just dumb mistakes. And then in coming out of that, seeing the things that I do share with my mother that aren't necessarily normal, that aren't necessarily socially acceptable, kind of make me a better artist, make me think a little differently, and make me very self-aware and careful. So there's some good things that have come out of it.
Yeah. You talk about, you know, the promiscuity in your teens and the early drug use in your teens and all of the self-destructiveness basically sort of culminates in you're becoming a heroin addict essentially just to show somebody, to prove something to somebody else.
Yes.
And it really seems like that brief period of heroin addiction was really sort of the moment at which you were able to step back and say, like, okay, this has got to change.
Well, yeah, it was kind of like, okay, well, I was laying there after a particularly terrible experience going, all right, well, if this is going to be your life, you just stay right here, you know? You can either die, you could stay here, or you can get up and go do something else. Because you will die if you stay here. Maybe not right away, but you'll fucking want to. And that's kind of that, the suicide thing, was what my mom's go-to thing was. And I'd always sworn I would never take my own life, ever take my own life, because that was the biggest pussy move, cruel, selfish move. And so, you know, a voice in my head very clearly said, if you were dead, you wouldn't feel this way. And that was kind of, that was enough to get me started to climb back out.
And it seems like it's at that point that you really started getting serious about your artistic ambitions.
Yeah. Well, I just, everything that had been driving me through life, I always felt like I had been dragged through that part of my life. Like I was, my boot was stuck on a strap attached to a wild horse going fucking crazy through a carnival. And I was just being dragged, and I was just responding to what I could in the moment. And all of it was looking for love, like trying to find where I belong, trying to feel like I belong, trying to find someone to love me. And drugs make you kind of numb, or they mimic love and affection. Sex obviously mimics love and affection in a transient sort of way. But in getting up on stage and playing music, I'm basically, without any guile or innuendo, asking a room full of strangers to give a shit about me for just an hour. And I do it with something that I manufacture within myself, as opposed to getting high or fucking them. I'm giving them something of myself, and they're giving me something of themselves. And it just seemed like a much more of a healthy, honest exchange, because you can't do that when you're high. Well, some people can. I can't. I can't do it drunk. I can't do it high. I can't do it half-assed. I have to be healthy. And so it made me feel more love in those 30 to 90 minutes on stage than anything else in my history. So that became my dope and my love.
And actually, you know, the thing that you're saying about the relationship with the audience while you're on stage brings up an interesting point that kind of gets touched on obliquely a little bit here in the memoir, is that over the last couple of years in Portland, after you had done the TV show and then mm-hmm. the theatrical thing, you were sort of invited to basically do, you know, an evening of your life as a show.
Yes, I was asked to write. Well, I did a Cabaret, and the director of Cabaret asked me to write a one-woman show about my life, and it took him a long time to convince me to do it, because I thought it sounded like a stupid, boring idea. I'm like, why do you want to hear those sad fucking stories? It's boring, you know? I'm fine now. I'm great. I'm awesome. And but it was a really, really interesting exploration back into what steps created me now, where I'm walking around all tall and tough, and I think I'm fine, but you're still carrying all of those things from... Because most people look back on terrible things in their past as a snapshot, going, oh, yeah, oh, that was such a hard summer. Remember that summer where so-and-so died, and that was so hard. And then let's move on. But then you put on the skin of that person you were when that terrible thing happened, and you go back. You see that that's really still in your... You don't have to dwell on it, but you're carrying it. And that was a really fascinating thing, and I was really surprised how much people loved it. this deep archaeological dig into the shit of yourself.
Right, and you were just talking about it in this. You were singing as well.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's a musical memoir. Crazy enough, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, what was the transition like? And I guess first off, how did the transition come about from doing Crazy Enough, the musical, to being invited or deciding you wanted to try Crazy Enough, the book?
Well, while I was writing the script, I was asked to perform at a benefit for Wordstock, which is a big literary fundraising event in Portland. My friend Larry Colton is the founder of that nonprofit, and so he asked me to be a musical guest, and then found out that I was working on a script and asked me to see what I had been working on, and so I so I sent him some pages. I said, I'm not really a writer, I'm kind of just a musician. But sure, if you want to see it. And so he looked at some of my script, and then he called me a few days later and said, I hope you don't mind. I went ahead and sent your writing to my agent in New York, and I really think you have a book here. And I laughed. I'm like, you're crazy. I'm a musician. I'm lazy. I keep weird hours. I can't be held accountable for sitting down and writing a book. That takes education. That takes serious dedication of time and focus. And I am dyslexic, ADD, and I type with one hand. I can't do it. Then I start getting harassed by this agent who will be here tonight, Richard Pine. Hey, I think you need to write a book proposal. I really think you need to write a book proposal. And so, very begrudgingly, while I'm performing this show, these guys are henpecking me to do it. So I finally do it, and then the agent calls and says, I need you to come to New York because there's some people who want to talk to you. I said, who? I said, well, publishers. For what? They want your book. What? And so when, crazy enough, wrapped in the theater, I flew to the East Coast and walked around with Richard Pine to several different publishers and met with all of them. And I think we met with five, six, and I finally went with Free Press. And I didn't think I was going to get a book deal until I got the call. So it was a very weird and guilt-ridden. I'm guilt-ridden over it because I have so many people like, do you know how long people beg to get a book deal and how do you just... I'm like, I really don't know. But I'm really excited and honored and flattered that they asked, and I'm really stunned and amazed that I did it because I wrote this book in Portland, Los Angeles, Australia, Scotland, London, where else? New York, San Francisco, Indianapolis. Oh no, sorry. Was it Minneapolis? Yeah, it was Minneapolis. I've been on tour this whole time writing, and so that is crazy. And so thank God for my editor Leah, who helped me keep it together. But yeah.
So apart from not having the songs, what would you say like the similarities are between the show and the book?
A lot of the stories from the show are in the book, only a little more fleshed out, a little more set up, a little more background. Let's see. Yeah, I think that's it. You'll recognize a lot of stories, but I give my mother so much more of a center stage in this book, so you can really get to know her better.
And is Crazy Enough what you're bringing to Off-Broadway for you?
Yes, yeah, Crazy Enough. We're shooting for fall 2012, I'm working with my director right now while I'm in New York, so...
Which is interesting. I mean, it kind of comes full circle to... you originally came to New York out of high school to study the dramatic arts.
Yes.
At the time, you were like, oh, yeah, this is not what I want to do.
Well, you know, it was... theater school was great because it showed me my strengths and my weaknesses immediately. Mm-hmm. My weakness being I was a horrible actor. Horrible. But a great singer. And my singing voice made me stand out. And they were very, very supportive of my singing voice, but they saw it as a device to get me on Broadway. And I didn't like the idea of Broadway at all because I felt myself a dirtbag rocker. But it is funny that I'm back doing musical theater, but it's not acting, and it's certainly not Broadway. It's a little more Hedwig than. You know, Les Miserables.
Great. And with one book under your belt now, is this ever something you think you'll be coming back to? Or?
Yes, I now that I know I can do it, I feel I have a little more swagger, a little more confidence that I can physically get a book done. I'd love to try fiction because I don't want to write about myself anymore. It's fucking brutal. But I'd love to write some fiction. I'd love to write maybe screenplays.
Cool. Well, we are about to get ready for this event here at Powerhouse Arena, and we'll actually be recording some of the songs that that Storm will be playing tonight. So thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you very much.
So this next song, really quickly, I'm playing songs from the show Crazy Enough that I'm working on, hopefully, to get to New York City in the fall. This next song I wrote in a rage because I was really fucking mad. Are there children here? There was a little kid reading some How to Cross the Street book and shit. Is that you? Okay, good. Yeah, you just cross the street. Don't get hit. There you go. But I was mad because I, part of the show, I really wanted to have this song by David Bowie. I wanted to have Rock and Roll Suicide as part of the show because there was this part of my life where I was doing heroin and I was being a dumb fuck, and I did all this China White by myself and blacked out. And basically what started happening as I was fading in and out and fading in and out, watching the little CD counter on my stereo, and I was kind of like, if I make it to track 11, if I wake up and I hear Rock and Roll Suicide, that means I'm not going to die. And I was like throwing up. It was stupid. And I was sitting there. I was just like, oh, stay awake for track 11. And so I wrote this heartfelt letter to David Bowie. And I was like, Mr. Bowie, I just want you to know that your song, Rock and Roll Suicide, was like the turning point in my life. And it was a great letter. It was a great letter. And I made sure that tears landed on the paper, so the blurry ink and all that. So he'll be like, "Oh my God, Iman, read this. I'm so moved." So I said, I asked him, "Could I please have permission to use your song, Rock and Roll Suicide, in my show, Crazy Enough?" And I waited and waited and waited and waited and waited. Meanwhile, we're in rehearsals for Crazy Enough to get up and running in Portland. And it was 2 weeks before the show got up and running, where my lawyer calls me and goes, "I've heard from David Bowie." I'm like, "Oh my God, you heard from David Bowie. Did he cry? Was he moved? Is he going to come to the opening night?" They've refused the license. What do you mean? It was a really good letter. How do you refuse the license? He said, "Well, it wasn't David Bowie. It was David Bowie's people. And David Bowie's people said that they refused the license for the artist known as Storm Large because we looked into the artist who is known as Storm Large, and we found her to be sexually irresponsible." So anyway, I was infuriated. I was really angry. And I was like, "Where the fuck are we going to? Oh, my God, what are we going to? That's the scene. That's the fucking scene. What are we going to do? What are we going to do?" So we wrote this other song. And to be clear, I'm sure David Bowie never saw my awesome letter. It was just his stupid people who don't know any better. But this is the song that I wrote in response inside of that.
that gather every year and that light their candles and dry their tears. Oh, I'm not a shining star. I don't know who you are. I'm just that girl who's dying to know. No, I'm just a nobody. Can anyone hear me? I'm just that girl who's dying to know. I can't go on unloving and unknown. Oh, yes, stop being crazy. Won't somebody save me?
Michael Shapiro, ladies and gentlemen. My much better half.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Life Stories, a Beatrice.com podcast. I'm Ron Hogan, and I hope you'll join us again for another interview sometime soon. Take care.